I always think humour and satire are a bit like nuclear energy. You can use it for good or for ill.
Okay, I'm going to open the AI image for chapter by Robert and myself.
Okay, wow. So this in a way does feel like a dream.
It's not the first Godzilla with ears, it's one of the later ones. What can I say about this? Wow. It's not clear what this is.
The graphic style is rendered by the AI in a painterly kind of fashion, which might suggest something about the link between old media and new. The image is presented in a portrait format that echoes the phone screen. Kind of makes me want to click on it to find out more.
I really can make nothing much of the images except a vague embodied grossness.
There's not much kindness in this image.
We've just heard this compilation of amazing reactions that we asked the authors of this book collection to voice. Ben, can you explain to us what the reactions are?
Oh, they're fantastic. They are amazing, if you want to know. We didn't tell the authors that we would turn their chapters into AI-generated images that we would post inside the book ahead of each chapter. We actually then asked the authors to confront those images and to actually think a bit more about what does it feel like for them to be seen and their work to be seen by the AI algorithm in a way that kind of puts them in a different position, you know, where they cannot really speak on their own behalf, but they are being seen by the machine or by some process in a way that might be confronting, interesting, curious, you know, maybe weird, awkward, who knows. But we thought, why don't we put that in the conclusion? So, Mark.
The reactions of the authors were as individual as senses of humour, that they had a confrontation that they didn't expect and that, in a sense, threw back at them, their work, in a new light, though.
What I love about it is just this sense of play and innovation and these interesting ways in which we are starting to explore and understand AI technology. So I love it as a device that makes me connect with some of the slightly less sinister, perhaps, applications for ChatGPT and AI algorithms. But also what it does is it enables us to capture the authors' voices and a spontaneous moment of surprise. And it's worth then at this point talking about why on earth we've decided to record the conclusion to the book in sound. So, Mark, did you want to kick off about explaining for us why approach the conclusion in this way?
Well, I think in the 21st century now, as academics, we've just got to try and various ways of reaching audiences, not just students in front of us in a classroom, but hopefully people across the world through sound, and communicate our ideas in ways that people from all sorts of backgrounds can hear and understand. And I think it involves not just the ordinary traditional lecture, it involves podcasts, it involves AI, it involves novel ways of getting across our excitement and our interest in our research in humour studies. And we want people to feel that and understand the sort of things that we're understanding.
I love that because sometimes in academic work, the humanity of it can become stripped out in the efforts to be very clinical and very technical in the way that we approach our work. And this is a really deliberate choice to inject that back in, isn't it?
Yes. And of course, academics shouldn't use the personal pronoun and they shouldn't say I. It's always objective language and all that sort of thing. But I think we've got to drop that sort of pretense now. I think we've got to approach these things differently. And not be afraid of saying we're really excited about this stuff. Yeah. And we think this sort of work and analysis of humour in the world today brings something extra to our understanding of the world at this moment of time.
Ben, I know you've always been a passionate advocate for audio. You've always had a really strong connection with it. What do you see as the benefits of talking about the experience of the 4 years that you've taken to put this work together in this concluding audio form?
And you hear in the background, you hear, you know, the sound of me ripping out my hair, like strand by strand, and like, ow. So it was an interesting process. It's, I think, the PC term for this. You know, as Mark was saying, because I think the audience today is telling you what it wants, and it wants to be not necessarily entertained, but it wants to be made curious. So in a sense, what other, you know, formats or tastes or interesting ways of serving up academic knowledge are out there? And with that, I might just actually throw it back to you, Helen. What other ways are there for people to find another access point, you know, when it comes to knowledge that is so dense and sometimes so hard to capture? It's like grasping at almost something as thin as air. And you're like, so there must be another way, you know, there should be. And so I thank Mark for being willing to go on this, whatchamacallit, journey.
Journey, there's that word.
With us on it, you know. But yeah, I think again, how else? That, you know, what motivates me all the time, how else can this be done? But Helen, what do you think?
The reason that I love working in spoken word audio, it's partly pragmatic. It's just efficient, you know, and I think more and more we find ourselves in really densely packed lives. And for me, the easiest path to understanding is through connection, and I connect much more readily with the contents and the subject matter if I have a connection with the people who are telling me the stories. And so spoken word audio allows us to do that, and it also allows us to do that while we're doing other things. So if I'm commuting, if I'm cleaning, if I'm cooking, there's ways in which I can connect with information and knowledge and characters and people. And I find that a lot less threatening and intimidating, particularly when you're talking about academic knowledges, is that it feels friendlier, it feels warmer and more embracing. And that's what I love about hearing that collection of voices and that spontaneous reaction, is that we're not experiencing the authors then in this very formal context and through this quite dense, often academic language, but as through this kind of connection of spontaneous humanity and right. In the first instance.
Really another way, and I think, you know, Mark, you had an interesting way of talking about it when we had like chats about how else, what other ways are there to meet the authors? You know, is it just in the chapters? Is it just by reading that? Or how else can you actually get a sense of these are the humans?
And I should say that we do have an unexpected in some ways guide for this discussion. Dr. Jessica Milner Davis recorded a sort of collection of musings, I would say, as part of her reaction to her AI piece. And we've decided to use those as little marker chapters throughout our conversation. So you will hear Jessica's voice as we transition between topics. And again, she is our, I guess, representative author in this space to carry us through this conversation.
When the human image combines with that of the non-human or the animal, caricature passes from the realm of realism to that of iconographic fantasy, where hybrid monsters and demigods live.
Ben, I'm going to ask you, can you start to map out from the beginning just a quick overview of the authors and the chapters that people can delve into as part of this collection?
Right. I mean, at least I can try with a bit of help from Mark here, if that's okay, because I think, again, there is something in there, as if I can just map it out for people's tastes, and famously tastes are different, you know. And I think if you're interested, for instance, in this intersection of humor and technology and what's funny on your phone and why you're interested in, let's say, memes in an election cycle in America, you go to Lucien Leon's chapter and he's writing about Breitbart memes on Facebook. Something I thought I would really not come across was this, the question of how your device using humorous content is manipulating you in a way that benefits the ruling party in a country as important as, you know, America. Then I thought, all right, so, and if you go on from there, and if you say, I'm really interested in the political side of humorous manipulation of voters in a big industrial state like America, you might go and see Mark's chapter, because Mark is writing about the industry apparatus around the humor economy of Donald Trump and his election campaign. You might again go from Mark's chapter to Jessica Davis's chapter. And Jessica explains, I think, in a very interesting way, nuanced. You hear her talk about this idea of stereotyping and how stereotype humor kind of can be both denigrating, you know, uplifting, can be empowering, disempowering, can be good and bad, depends on the vantage point. And that brings us to the question of morality, which in the moral dimensions of humor, this book is all about and entitled. And that brings you to the next chapter, which is by Rob Fidian and Ron Stewart. And they're talking about this same idea of, well, politics, good, bad stereotypes. And they talk about lots of satirical images in newspapers.
Yes, to take up what Ben was saying about stereotypes, and especially with the chapter by Rob and Ron on the issue of Asian stereotypes, and particularly if the cartoonists involved are white Australians, and the offence that was created and the controversy and the diplomatic controversy between Australia and Indonesia at the time of some of these cartoons, and how they then later say in the chapter about an Asian Australian cartoonist and his depiction of Xi Jinping. So it goes to the question of not, as some people think, stereotypes are bad. I read about that sort of thing quite often, that we shouldn't be stereotyping people. But my answer to that is, how else are we to make generalisations of peoples? Whatever type they are, accountants, bakers, French people, Greeks, what have you. We all make generalisations. And sure, there are always exceptions to the rule of the generalisations. But nationalism, the Australian, the New Zealander, the German, are in a sense based on stereotypes.
Shortcuts to meaning. We can't deal with all the detail all of the time.
An Australian is like this. They all drink beer and what have you, whatever you have. So it's not a question of, are stereotypes bad, but how are they used? And that cuts to the quick about Ron and Rob's chapter about how they get used. And then we can go to Will Visconti's chapter on Mae West. And this was very illuminating for me when I first read Will's chapter, because he was talking about an old Hollywood starlet that I knew, a woman called Mae West, and the plays that she wrote for the 1920s, which were very avant-garde for their time. And she's dealing with gender and sex and gay stereotypes and transgender people and sex workers depicted on stage as heroes, and they were the bad stereotypes of their era. And here were all these mainstream Americans flocking to Broadway theatres to see these plays about people that they denigrated outside the theatres. And, of course, now there's been a complete turnaround in how those people, those stereotypes, are treated in a much more accepting and good way. A turnaround from being monsters in the 1920s to heroes or ordinary people of the 21st century. And so this is where we get into some of the issues of morality, as Ben said, about what is good and bad in the way we use stereotypes, particularly when you look over time, they can change, as Will very aptly shows. And then we turn to the chapter by M.W. Shaws about the stereotypes depicted in monster form of early modern Japan of the 17th and 18th century. And they were little morality narratives. They were little characters in protest and also in confirmation of what was good and bad in those times. So that gives an historical depth as well to this issue of what Jessica discusses in her chapter as stereotypes.
I mean, just to round it off there, you know, then you go to the last chapter that we can have, maybe to mention it here, is three authors, you know, writing as a team, an interdisciplinary team. You have, it almost sounds like a joke setup, you know, what happens if a virologist, a pop culture person, and a literary studies person go into, like, I guess, a cyber room to, you know, write a chapter, and that's Anna-Sophie Jürgens, that's Anastasia Fyodorova and David C. Chark, and they wrote about the Joker, like this comic cartoon character. Most of us might know him, you know, white face, but, you know, it's actually an interesting long-standing character trope, which is this horrendous smile of the Joker. And they are writing about the virology aspect, that, you know, they talk about the fact that laughter can be so alluring, it can be so nice, so inviting. What will happen if you take the laugh as a concept and make it something infectious? So they write about the Joker being able to infected with a laugh disease, mixing compounds in water, in your public water supply of big city, Gotham City, here for the nerds, we're looking into comics here, and people get infected and they laugh themselves to death. What happens if laughter were as dangerously infectious and lethal as COVID?
Just the laughter pandemic.
The laughter.
Without any humour. It's got all the signatures, supposedly, of humour. Mm. You know, the Joker face, the enforced smile and all that sort of thing. The clown makeup, but no jests.
Are there any other concluding remarks you would like to make about a sort of a sense of overview or what the chapters represent as a collective?
For me, it goes back to the overarching theme of the book, which is the place of heroes and monsters in humour, but also in human history and societies more generally. We have always, as a species, been interested in heroes and monsters as ways of talking about good and bad, about morality, about the heroes who exemplify what we admire and what we want to achieve and what we consider as good, and the monsters who lurk in our midst, who threaten our society. They're a way of drawing cultural boundaries and barriers between what is to be included and what is to be excluded, who should be in the society and should be outside of the society. Some say that Donald Trump is a monster. He's a Godzilla, he's a Frankenstein, he's a Hitler, he's a dictator, he's a Caesar. And what they mean is that he should be excluded from political office and from political society. And of course, on the other hand, there are those who say he's another Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Rambo, or King Cyrus. He is the epitome of good in the world and good for America. These are old, old stories that we tell. As much as we are divided over Donald Trump, there's a line that runs from him through to the movies that we go and see, where we might be scared of a shark that is a monster in the seas and takes people, or scared of aliens that come to Earth, or scared of the serial killers. These stories are very, very old.
What strikes me as you're talking is the extent to which we find ourselves in a binary, and how much our existences now are kind of cleaved between these kind of really big binaries. Is there understanding to be found in binaries over dialectics, do you think, Ben?
There is big questions around the idea of humour studies in general. If you bring up the idea of this binary system, you know, like when we talked about the title for the book, you know, heroes, humans, monsters, they are polarizing terms, and you would not necessarily, again, call, you know, a hero a monster and a human, but with Trump, for instance, you know, for some people that might be the reality of who he is and why they vote for him. And Mark, again, shamelessly plugging Mark's chapter, go and have a look at it, please, if you can. This is why I think humor is so wonderfully complicated, because it is anti-boundary, fluid. It is so much more than, you know, these binaries that traditionally academia is all about, because, you know, that's how expertise, that's how disciplinarity works. So what does it mean then if you take scholarship to a place that is interstitial, that works against binaries, where things can be multiples at the same time? That's real life. And as Mark was saying, these are old stories. In academia, sometimes I feel like we're trying to tell old stories in new ways that forget the old and cast as something bad or something almost evil. But what if you tell that in an anti-binary way and say, look, all of this can be true at the same time. It depends on your vantage point, on the contextuality of it. So I think that's my answer to that. When it comes to, you know, why even have a collection that is so, at the first glance, you know, oppositional even. But if you have a look at all the chapters, they really are very harmoniously like going together very well.
When you were talking about binaries then, Helen, I was thinking of all the superhero movies around these days, the Marvel universe,
absolutely,
the DC Comics universe,
yeah,
and the heroes and monsters are very clear in those, yeah. Boom, kapow, wham, all the noises that go in between with these very simplistic ideas. And they're satisfying for a couple of hours of fun. And they depict good and bad in very clear ways. And, of course, we have to step outside the cinema, don't we, and deal with life in general. And when it comes to politics, which is the background to my area of study, that's when people get nervous and also dismissive and cynical, and I can understand that because the simplistic binaries don't always work.
Well, I think that's what makes a lot of people cynical about political discourse, right, is that, you know, what we tend to see and experience is this really reductive representation, yes, of the other. That's kind of what politics has become. There is no more nuance. There's no pretense of understanding or collaboration or, you know, working towards a greater good collectively. It's the guys on the other side are bad guys and we are good guys. And so I guess from my point of view, understanding why we sink into binaries is really important, and how we sometimes find the space in between.
And if I can just maybe turn it around on Helen, you know, if that's okay, I was just wondering, you know, from your point of view, working in audio podcast in the spoken word space, what to you would constitute that binary for the ear?
I think for me, one of the reasons I love working with voices is because I think they help us transcend binaries. I think the other thing about this form is that we have a bit of time, whether we're on the radio or in a podcast format. Mm-hmm. Podcast time is much looser than broadcast time. But even so, in the presenting experiences I've had as a broadcaster, I'd be on air for 2 hours. And it's really unusual in most other media forms to have that companionship with the person that's talking to you for that duration. And I think what's great about spoken word is it's very hard to maintain too much of a pretense for too long, right, in that space. And so what you get is more opportunity for nuance and detail and finer discrimination about individuals or subjects or and I think it's one of the beauties of being able to have this discussion in this space is that we can start to tease apart. We can do both things in a sense. We can get the benefit of what binaries give us in terms of the starkness of the understandings, because like stereotypes, we don't want to kind of diminish everything in single terms as good or bad. And I think binaries can illuminate things, right? But I think...
And they're interesting, I guess.
Yeah. And they
you want to get beyond the sound bites.
Exactly right. But we've also got sound bites in here, right?
Yeah,
sound
right. Sound bites are useful.
And it's nothing more satisfying than a really succinct surmising of an idea as well, which is what Jessica does for us so well.
Right.
But yeah, I think what's so great about voices and time and listening, if we can listen, like for me, listening is the kind of missing ingredient in the world. As soon as we take time and as soon as we listen, then I think our capacity for understanding is enormously increased. And for me, that's the opportunity of this vehicle.
There are training programs now to help people develop a so-called sense of humour. But everybody's sense of humour is unique, just as every human being is unique.
So in a sense, our book is about exploring those sound bites and going further.
it really makes sense to kind of think about it as, why are we doing this sonic conclusion? We're sitting in a studio, the listener might not know, but it's wonderfully like, what do we call the colour of the walls?
It's very burnt orange, isn't it?
Just burnt orange. Government-issue carpet. So I would say, it's like we're trying to warm up knowledge beyond these binaries of, print, book, ear, audio. And going back to this, the initial discussion we had about, so what do we hope with these? It's again like with the terms, gods, monsters, evil, good, whatever we want to call it. But what happens if you undo these things? With, for instance, Marx or Roberts and Ron's chapters, you have politics and humor. You have Trump and humor. With Will, you have gender and humor. You have play and theater and humor and drag and humor. So it's always this element of plus that we're trying to get after here. And, just what you were saying, Helen, about the ear, the wonderful thing is in audio you can add that and you can, develop it and it can live and it can change while on air, while you are in a dialogue. I think this is the first time people have attempted a sonic conclusion. And for us, this is, thanking you here as well for this. It's just trying something new. And I think that's what humor research is, to me at least, all about, to try something different. I was just actually going to throw it back to you with one more question there. What are your reactions? So you are opening a file that says AI images and captions. What is your reaction? And also again, from this audio podcast, producing mind or ear, are you just going, this is nuts, this is bonkers, does it give humans, does it give gods and monsters? What was your impression and were you thinking, how do I translate this into sound? What do we do here? Can you maybe just talk to us about that?
What appeals to me about this subject area and just even this form of scholarship is the sort of undercurrent of transgression that imbues the whole process, and the fact that the opportunity for transgression emboldens you, I think, as a creative collaboration and your authors. And so you've experimented with these things that are really different, like how can we use this new technology, which people are deeply ambivalent about in the first instance, but how do we kind of walk up to it and poke it and see what it is that we can do and apply it in interesting ways? And I think it's a genius move on your part to just kind of throw that into the mix, and that this is a space where you can do that. I think that's what's so exciting about this field of endeavour, is that what you've done is you've cast this net which has drawn in all these other really interesting creative impulses and welcomed me into the space as well to be part of the discussion, because to then think about expressing the work in sound and the opportunity to produce academic work and a very specific type of academic work, an edited collection's introduction and conclusion are very distinct pieces of work that are, part of a well-recognized form. So to have the opportunity to think about what is it that we do in this space, what is it that audio can contribute to this form, is really exciting.
And, just because of previous collaborations with you, Helen, but I think, when we were Mark and I were talking a lot about, so what can we do with this? And I thought of you as, again, I'm in popular culture, I'm doing lots on popular technologies of mediation, film, for instance. I come back to this thing, people have maybe seen this glorious comedy called Sister Act, where Whoopi Goldberg tries to wrangle a couple of nuns, into a choir, and have them sing in unison. And I thought, right, the film starts out, they have no clue what they're doing. It's a cacophony of sounds. It's like big nuns, small nuns, old nuns, young nuns, and they're all trying to sing in different keys and whatever. And she, the premise of the film, spoilers, is managing that. And they sing beautifully, like an angelic choir. And I thought, so we have these diverse voices there. Can Helen be a Whoopi? Can Helen whoop it for us? So Helen, again, thanks for doing this. But again, hopefully that, how do you feel about a task like that?
Whoopi Wolfenden.
Yeah, that's right. Gosh, I'm really, I need to incorporate that into my name somehow. Look, it feels like a big responsibility because you guys have done this work and your authors have put together this amazing collection of what I think are really important ideas. And as I say, I'm really excited by this form of scholarship, which I think has had its challenges over the years. I guess I hope it works. I hope people like it. I can't, you know, I wouldn't, this has very much been an experience of giving something a try for the first time. So trying things out, right. Some things that have worked. We've asked our authors to record things, many things that we've not used. I know, you know, you've experimented with how do we create a conversation that is succinct and meaningful and connects up the ideas. There's a lot of heavy lifting really that has to work in the sonic space to make this work. And so, you know, how do we get enough of the author's voices in there? There's a lot of really interesting creative dimensions, and I'm sure we won't have it all right in this instance. Right. Yeah. But I think we have a go, and hopefully that encourages other people to both experiment with this form. And I think one of the commitments probably that we all have is to making knowledge available so that it moves out of academic silos and into spaces where interested, reflective people can start to engage in conversations that have some real substance and some thinking and some meaning behind them. So, you know, you don't necessarily need to be a humor studies scholar and have all of the granularity of every element. But even just to engage in this kind of conversation, hopefully you come away from it richer, and we build on ideas and things get bigger rather than kind of reductive models or that sense when you're consuming media of having sort of taken something in but really having eaten a lot of empty calories, you know.
I don't think humour is mechanical. It uses mechanisms. But I think we use humour individually, personally.
Certainly, universities talk a lot these days about transdisciplinarity and interdisciplinarity. And it doesn't always come off because it's done in the traditional little boxes and that sort of thing. But certainly, I think that we're employing it here in going across the audio and the visual in this book. But there's still barriers to break down, as you're implying, Whoopi.
Yeah. And that is how I will only, Dr. Whoopi, actually.
Dr. Whoopi from now
on. It's the only way to address me from
not,
here on
not
in.
Not Dr. Phil, Dr. Whoopi.
That's right.
And universities, in many respects, although they've moved into the postmodern studies and that sort of thing, these are merely, in a sense, updates of very traditional lines of thinking. You know, you get your great thinkers, your Michel Foucault, et cetera, and then you line students up and teach them the right way to read the sacred texts and then churn out the essays and tests and all that sort of stuff. And yet that is very traditional in its approach.
Academia is very conventional.
And
it's very hard to break out of those conventions.
And that's one of the problems for humour studies.
Right.
It doesn't fit into one little box marked politics or psychology or chemistry or linguistics. We have a diverse range of disciplines looking at this complex phenomenon known as humour, drawing from the sciences and the arts and the humanities and social sciences, from management to linguistics to psychology and so forth. There's no single great text. A lot of it is we come together and give different angles on this one supposed thing. And we enjoy that. But it still frightens a lot of academics. And most academia don't give much credence to humour studies.
Or, if I can just quickly...
it's non-serious or something like that.
If I can just quickly add here, it's the credence, but it's also the basic premise of what we are trying to do here right now, or what Helen, you know, is so masterfully adding here, is how to have fun. And I think humour studies is the most ideal place to start. What if you have fun with knowledge, with being a knowledge producer? And to me, that is always, you know, why we did this kind of enterprise of this sonic conclusion, the AI images, dragging Helen into her own studio and having Whoopi Wolfberg working with us here. So, I mean, if I, again, if that's okay, throw it back to Helen here, because you know that it is all about making things sound engaging and fun. And I think that is, at the end of the day, why, thanks to our authors, they lent us their voices to try to make it engaging and fun. And the book is open access, so everybody can download it for free if they'd like. But they wouldn't if it weren't fun. Like with you working for the BBC and ABC, if it's a public medium, but nobody wants it, what is it going to be? Nothing. So maybe, Helen, can you maybe also give us your take on why it's not a bad thing for knowledge and for academia to be fun?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always felt like an outlier in academia because I am, because I'm a hybrid. I'm a practitioner academic. I think practitioner academics are always strange beasts who find themselves trying to traverse the sort of real world practice and then the academic encoding of knowledge. Mm. And I find myself routinely trying to disrupt academic discourses and ways of being because they can get so pompous and formal and full of self-importance.
No, academics that way. I find that hard to believe.
Who would have thought?
This is the moment where, you know, uni admin is cutting the feed.
That's right. Yeah. Boop, we cannot hear you anymore. So, by its very nature, spoken word audio deconstructs some of those academic conventions because it expresses knowledge informally, it expresses knowledge conversationally, in conversation, collaboratively. As you say, Mark, these are things that universities often talk about and aspire to but find very hard to achieve in practice. So the form straddles both the aspirations of universities, but also the kind of realities and anxieties of universities and of how we represent knowledge, which has been incredibly hard won, right? When you're not inside the academic system, it can be really difficult looking from the outside in to understand just how much work has gone into that knowledge creation process. Right. And that's why academics get defensive about that. So there is this kind of loveliness about being a hybrid, which means you kind of get a bit lost. You don't really belong in either world, but it does mean that you perhaps have a reasonably clear-eyed perspective of both, maybe, or either that, or you're just deluding yourself.
Right. I hope you're still ticking those boxes, though,
Helen. I don't tick any boxes. That's my problem, Mark.
Yeah, but you've got quite a boxes to tick every day, Helen.
I know.
But Helen, to exactly at this point, and maybe then I shut up, but you know, I think this really, like, what really makes it fun is vocality, is voice, is sound, is being in a social setting where, you know, sound is so important. I think, because I'm writing about synthetic laughs, I'm writing about the laugh box, and it's like, if I could have the reader go through the chapter and every time I say, you know, can laughter, they hear a laugh track. I was like, it would be, again, as I write in
I'd
the
really
chapter,
like to produce that.
Yeah, we should. But it's deeply problematic in terms of the ethical manipulation of your sense of humor. Or what is that even, you know? It is so mechanical and triggerable. At the push of a button, how can you make think about it in a better way than maybe without the canned laughter? So what would happen if I were to have that in the chapter? And I thought, interesting. So with Mark, you know, and Trump, or with Anna Sophie, the Joker, you know, again, going back to this virality of laughter, or even the alluring nature of humor and why scholars are so scared, it's because it opens up so much more space of experimentation, which to a lot of academics might be scary in a way, you know, or maybe just something that they have not ventured into.
Well, and I think you have to relinquish some control, which is the other thing that people who are very invested and have done, you know, lots of really hard fought work to achieve, understandably find hard to give up. For me, what I love is connection and relationships. And so the dynamism of a conversation, the generative nature of that are all really fundamental elements to the form that I choose to produce work in. It's, I might say, really confusing for universities to work in an invisible, ephemeral medium. So I think we have lots of points of connection with some of the anxieties that exist in the humour studies world. But it's also really liberating and such a great opportunity to experiment and try different things. And if you're not doing that, then you're maybe a bit dead inside. Maybe that's just me.
But you can still apply for university grants even if you are dead inside.
Oh, yes, I believe that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
I think as well that there's the challenge of moving to different audiences, away from an audience, an academic audience that knows your jargon, to a non-academic audience and to speak jargon-free, but still in a way that communicates your ideas. And that is a challenge for everybody. But also that means that moving away from jargon is to move away from, in a sense, concerns that have been dictated for you by a discipline. Now, one of the things about humour studies is that, of course, it challenges the boundary between the serious and the non-serious. And for a lot of academics, that's a very severe demarcation. But also, if you said to a lot of academics, hey, why don't you study hegemony? They'd say, oh, yes, it's important because you've got to deconstruct, open up this issue of what passes for common sense in society, what people generally think is common sense is socially constructed and it's pertaining to a particular time, a particular society, a particular culture, and all that sort of thing. And it comes across as so natural. Okay, well, if you cross out the word hegemony and put humour in, you've got exactly the same situation, that you've got something that passes every day for common sense with a lot of people, and they don't reflect on how that sort of thing is dictated by time and context and society and shared knowledge, all the things by which you could study the concept of hegemony. And yet, a lot of academics are afraid of making that sort of switch.
And I think people who are not within academic circles would be surprised to hear that academics are not paying more attention to analysing and understanding humour, because it is this really fundamental cornerstone, I think, of people's lives, right? So why would that not be a thing that's being paid attention to? I think many people would be really surprised to hear that it's been such a site of conflict, maybe that's too strong a word, but certainly anxiety and resistance, in the sense of people going, I just, you know, don't want to go there. Because, you know, that's
in many ways
a much better way to describe it. And that sense of going, well, it's diminished by its popularity or its pleasure, in a sense.
The paradox is that humour studies has arisen principally over the last 50-odd years, since the 1970s. And yet, the knowledge of humour studies is fairly impoverished compared to what was known more than 200 years ago, what was discussed about laughter and humour amongst intellectuals prior to the 19th century. Since the 1970s, humour studies has been dominated by psychology. We're coming out of that dominance now over the last 10 years or so to a much broader understanding. But our knowledge has been fairly impoverished, as I say, compared to the early moderns who discussed rhetoric and laughter and the varieties of laughter that we were discussing at the beginning of this podcast. They were well aware, and so were the ancient Greeks and Romans, about these sorts of things. And the early moderns recycled ancient theories about it. And that happened up until the 18th century. During the last 200 years, as we've developed the idea of humour, and that's roughly 200 to 300 years, is the history of the concept of humour as we know it in the English language. Our knowledge of humour, our academic knowledge of humour, has in a sense declined, which is a paradox given we pride ourselves on the advancement of knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. And why this collection is so important. So I want to issue you both a challenge. What is the gauntlet you throw down? What is it that you say to the people who read this and are obligated, of course, to put the next edited collection together?
Good luck. Not us. Not us.
I think the next stage is to look at artificial intelligence and humour, because it's already coming through. And it's coming through in election campaigns as part of these inroads of AI into politics. So that's where I'm looking, and I think a lot of work will come out in that area in future years.
Ben?
Oh, Helen. Oh. I keep going back to what Mark was just saying about maybe not necessarily just thinking forward, but also thinking, you know, back in time to what the authors are pointing out, like M.W. Shores is pointing out. If you look at Japan through the lens of humor, you might be kind of wowed by the fact of how progressive folktales and fairy tales are dealing with humor as a moral stabilizer in society, where, you know, a lot of times from like a Eurocentric viewpoint, that might be surprising, that might be new, it might just not be talked about. So to me, as Mark was saying, it is AI, it is fairy tales, it is performance, it is discrimination, it is misogyny, it is drag, it is all these wonderfully different things. So I'm finding it very hard to just put a definite label on it from my own personal interest area here. I'm really interested in how deeply mechanical and human laughter is, and how that kind of, you know, questions our idea of how synthetic, how mechanical are we as people, as humans. But at the same time, I think, you know, if I were, and again, throwing it back to Helen here, the move that we've now come to understand is the best thing if you don't know quite what to say. How would you feel about exploring laughter more, or just the idea of humor in your area, you know, as a sound scholar? What would that sound like? And this, again, to be my challenge to people, what does your work sound like?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think everyone is going to necessarily want to work in sound. And in terms of the strands that I was picking up from what it is that you were saying, is that in order to be able to do this work, you have to kind of sit in discomfort, right? And there's something actually kind of uncomfortable about humor. Maybe that's what makes us laugh or react. And that is true for scholarship as well. Our challenge to do uncomfortable scholarship, right, and to push into boundaries that kind of have some appeal but make you nervous, maybe that sort of dark corner that you're not prepared to look at.
The tingle, as we call tingle. It, the intellectual, you know, tingle.
And maybe that's sound, maybe that's the transgressiveness that speaking about knowledge in more accessible ways represents for academics. Maybe it's about collaborations that feel hard within the existing structures of universities, despite the encouragement to do this interdisciplinary work, when in reality the practice is much harder and difficult to fit into institutional metrics. So from my perspective and the good fortune I've had to be involved in this project, I think that's what I see as the challenge going forward, is to continue to put yourself in the spaces of discomfort.
Thank you, Whoopi. I'll be Thanks mother. So much. Given my age, I'll be Mother Superior.
Anytime. You're welcome.
And before, Smith. Just to again thank all the authors for contributing to this and for lending us their time, their voices, and to also thank one of the collaborators who's not right now on the podcast recording, which is Jacob Craig from the University of Sydney, who is also involved in this Sonic Conclusion endeavor.
In this
Goodness. So the first thing I'm looking for in the image is a 100 demons, or at least one demon, and I'm not really seeing any except perhaps for one.
The color's nice. I really don't know what to make of this. Interesting, is all I can say.
The algorithm can't handle figures of speech, so the idea of monstrousness in a less than literal sense.
I see great potential in AI art as a method and result, not only of captivating and fun research illustrations and depictions and representations, but also of critical thinking.
When I first opened this, I wanted to ask, well, what the hell? This doesn't represent what I've written or what I've researched at all. But the more I look at it, I suppose, the more perfectly it starts to make sense. And I suppose that frightens me as well, because we're at what seems to be the dawn of the AI generation.